The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Century, we're going to look at human rights and the drug war. Angela McBride is the Executive Managing Director of the South African Network of People Who Use Drugs. She spoke recently at an event organized by the International Network of People Who Use Drugs entitled Navigating Tensions and Contradictions, Addressing Human Rights Challenges Related to the Lack of and the Unequal Access to Treatment and Harm Reduction.
I'm really grateful to be here today, and I'm going to try and summarize this as much as possible. And I think ultimately in South Africa, we've noticed that the biggest challenge, and it's a challenge that we find a lot of the time when it comes to harm reduction and addressing the needs of the community, is the lack of funding, or at least in some cases in South Africa, the supply is not meeting the demand. Whether it's through informal or formal consultations, observations through community-led monitoring that's been happening, the community is frustrated that there isn't enough access to OAT. There isn't enough access to needles and syringes. And unfortunately, this is frustrating within itself. And the service providers, a lot of the time, are the ones who are blamed for this from the community's perspective. But it is deeper than that. It runs deeper than that because budgets are the restriction. If we don't have government buy-in, if we don't have sufficient funding coming in to procure needles and syringes, to procure methadone, or at least to subsidize some of these costs, it is impacting our movement forward. And with this said, we know in South Africa that there are governments and municipalities that are providing services and are covering harm reduction commodities. So it is possible. However, it takes a lot of advocacy for that. It takes a lot of support. And through institutions, advocates, and advocacy, we can look at how we can push for more funding, more buy-in from our governments. But not only do we have the challenge of not enough supply to meet the demand, but we've also started to notice the lack of a living wage for peer educators. And I want to spend time speaking about that because I think we all hear enough about there. We need more needles. We need more needles, which is vital. We do need more needles. We need more OAT. We need more other like harm reduction commodities for other people who are using drugs and not necessarily just injecting drugs. But we also need to be considering the experts. Peer educators are the ones who are going out and providing the needles and syringes. Peer educators are the ones who are going out and doing HIV testing and counseling. They are doing the hardest work. You're seeing the people you love. You're seeing your friends having to tell someone you care about you now have hepatitis. That is the harsh reality in South Africa. But the peers, the people who are doing the hardest work, not sitting in offices, not sitting in aircon rooms, but actually going out and doing the physical work, they're getting paid nothing. And not literally nothing, but pretty much almost nothing. And there's no subsidization. Housing is not being subsidized. Methadone is hardly subsidized because there isn't enough money for methadone as is. And this is a massive problem because you've got institutions and organizations that receive large amounts of funding for harm reduction in South Africa, and they're not consulting with communities. They're not bringing their own peers into, I'm sorry, I get quite emotional about this, but they're not bringing their own peers into the room to discuss their budgets. They're not having the peer educator look at the budget and say, hold on, you haven't included an increase for me in the next 3 years. What about inflation? It's not being done, but yet, unfortunately, there are cases and spaces where the increases are considered for management. The increases are considered for rental or the likes of that. But the people who are doing the most work, the hardest work, the real work, they're not being paid a livable wage. And that is a massive problem, but it can be addressed. Include us in the conversations. When it comes to budget, as funders and donors, it is your responsibility to also hold that the person you are funding or the organization you're funding accountable to say, where has your community consultation come in? Have you consulted with the people that are doing the greatest amount of work and the most important work? So we need to be looking at it holistically. It's not just the peer holding the service provider accountable or the service provider holding the funder accountable for money. It's not about that. It's about ensuring that the people that are doing the work are getting paid a livable wage. Because ultimately, if you're hiring a peer, that means you're hiring a person who uses drugs. That means you are hiring someone who you're meant to be serving. And if the salary or the wage does not reflect harm reduction, reducing harm, then how can we say we're providing a harm reduction intervention? If someone is unable to afford rent, unable to afford methadone themselves, unable to afford meals, or if they receive a small amount of wage that can only cover those, where is the money for emergencies? Where is the money if they have children? Where is the money if they want to buy shoes or buy uniforms or buy a microwave? It is not there because there is not enough budget taken into account. So, long story short, yes, there is a need for more harm reduction commodities. There is a need for more people who use drugs interventions, like treatment for hepatitis, safe stimulant packs and the likes. But there also needs to be proper consultation with peer educators and in ensuring that there is a minimum wage provided. We cannot be sitting in a country and saying, oh, this is the minimum wage overall for a country, when we don't have a minimum wage for harm reduction and peer educators as well. There needs to be a livable wage. And if not, there needs to be a subsidization, either housing be made available or medication be made available. But we cannot be working forward and putting the people who are doing the work, the people who we are actually meant to be serving, we cannot be making them suffer because it contradicts the entire concept of harm reduction.
That was Angela McBride, Executive Managing Director of the South African Network of People Who Use Drugs, speaking at a recent event organized by the International Network of People Who Use Drugs entitled Navigating Tensions and Contradictions, Addressing Human Rights Challenges Related to the Lack of and the Unequal Access to Treatment and Harm Reduction. Another speaker at that event was Palani Narayanan, Director of the Drug Policy Program at the Malaysian AIDS Foundation.
The efforts towards drug policy reform in Malaysia has gained significant momentum in the last couple of years. The policy we are advocating for and working towards is decriminalization of drugs for use and personal possession. There is an increasing level of support among both government and non-government agency. We are approaching decriminalization policies from various angles, including prison overcrowding, impact on women and children, public health and economic cost, including enforcement, incarceration versus treatment. However, it's not without its challenges, but due to time constraint, I'll stick to the challenges around treatment issues only. You see, Malaysia successfully implemented a national harm reduction program in 2005 that brought the epidemic or the infection among people who use drugs by approximately 80%. Since then, we've had a high coverage of methadone and NSP programs in Malaysia. In the last several years, heroin use and injecting has reduced drastically, and ATS use has increased significantly. Now, HIV among people who use drugs is no longer a pressing issue for many stakeholders, and this makes advocacy for drug policy change through HIV a difficult one. The harms associated with drug use at the moment are violence, mental health, family disruptions, incarceration. And what are the harm reduction measures to prevent violence, mental health, incarceration? Treatment such as opioid substitution treatment is not available for ATS use, and services for mental health are few and far between. Traditional harm reduction services are closing due to the change of drug type, so people also question our investment in harm reduction now and drug policy now that we have HIV levels that are low. So people who use drugs, including gay men and transgender people who engage in chemsex, have very little contact with harm reduction services or treatment facilities. And in the name of preventing crime and violence, people who use drugs continue to be incarcerated or sent to mandatory drug rehabs. So we have to ask ourselves, and we do, we have saved thousands of lives through our harm reduction program and preventing HIV. Is saving lives enough? Is that where our moral and public health obligation ends? Is a life saved good enough if that life is being incarcerated 52 times before they reach the age of 40, as it happened to Siti? woman who uses drugs in Kuala Lumpur. Siti is a reminder that successful harm reduction programs alone is not going to make people who use drugs treated with respect, dignity, or human rights. We need drug policy to ensure that all the gains we make in harm reduction is sustained. We need to ensure that all harm reduction program guidance includes promotion of drug policy reform, or as my previous speaker said, harm reduction legislation. The second challenge is defining treatment and how we scale up treatment for people who need it. We don't believe and buy into the blanket statement that all people who use drugs need treatment. And so it has been critical for us to try and build on the understanding that many people who use drugs live productive lives. Problems arising from drug use during this time may need psychosocial assistance and counseling, but nothing more. A young man or a woman who is experimenting with marijuana does not need prison sentence alongside serious criminals in prison. Mm-hmm. But approximately 20% of people do develop dependency depending on the drug and will need treatment and support. For those who need treatment, the challenge is developing treatment modalities and that have evidence-based and are effective, not mandatory rehabilitation. Often treatment and rehabilitation is used interchangeably, very unfortunately. There are evidence for community-based treatments, such as therapeutic communities, but not for rehabilitation centers that spring up overnight in response to government crackdown and use modalities that include spraying jet water on people going through withdrawal and call it water therapy, or by chaining people who use drugs to beds, which happens across Asia. And what happens when we don't have enough treatment facilities? Where would people who are diverted from prisons to go? Will that recriminalize? Will we start recriminalizing, such as Oregon did in the US? So our decriminalization effort focuses not just on changing the laws, but making sure there are adequate treatment, evidence-based treatment facilities for people who use drugs at different phases of the spectrum of drug use. So to answer your question, Judy, on how decriminalization will lead to equitable treatment and harm reduction, number one, decriminalization will increase treatment-seeking behavior. When people feel safe and less fearful of being incarcerated, people who need assistance will come forward for treatment. Decriminalization will hopefully lead to better understanding of treatment and who needs it. Distinguishing the various reasons why people use is a start. Accepting that treatment is better than treating people as animals in cages through incarceration will hopefully follow. Decriminalization will hopefully increase funding for other treatment modalities, including community-based treatment. This is never guaranteed, of course, and as I mentioned earlier, needs to be crafted through careful advocacy strategy, particularly as we are talking about savings from law enforcement and incarceration to fund treatment. Now, changing this archaic, punitive, and repressive drug policies that has served to benefit a few while harming so many is not an easy task and will require coordination from all stakeholders, including Anti-Narcotics Board, Ministries of Health, community-based treatment, religious organization. But such is the complexity of drug use and magnitude of and complexity of drug use and drug dependence that we cannot just seek a simple answer or a quick fix. So by decriminalizing drug use for personal use and possession, we hope that our government will recognize that people are often on a spectrum of drug use, that we need different treatment for different people who use drugs, that not all people who use drugs need treatment, and certainly not always rehab, that treatment cannot be mandatory or forced, that treatment must be rooted in evidence and respect for human rights. We believe that people who use drugs cannot be punished for the society's and government's failings to prevent drugs from being produced, trafficked, or sold. Drug policies that focuses on punishing and incarcerating people who use is hypocritical and corrupt. Ladies and gentlemen, we must set out to change that.
That was Palani Narayanan, director of the Drug Policy Program at the Malaysian AIDS Foundation, speaking at a recent event entitled Navigating Tensions and Contradictions, addressing human rights challenges related to the lack of and the unequal access to treatment and harm reduction. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Former Philippine Senator Laila De Lima was imprisoned for nearly 7 years by the Duterte regime, framed for crimes she didn't commit because she spoke out against human rights abuses and extrajudicial killings there. She spoke recently at an event organized by StopTheDrugWar.org, DRCNet, entitled After a Drug War, Ending Extrajudicial Drug War Killings and Extending Transitional Justice for Victims.
It is an absolute pleasure to freely speak to all of you today about a very important topic. I say freely because apart from the attempt to silence me for close to 7 years inside prison walls, a lot of my countrymen are still shackled by varying degrees of restraint to speak about difficult topics such as accountability and transitional justice. Ironically, it was my unjust detention that allows me to be conscious of why others may not be as truly free to start the discussion on this sensitive topic. If anything, my imprisonment has strengthened my resolve to fight for freedom because I have experienced firsthand how it feels when liberty is taken away. Before anything, however, it is important for us to remember how we got where we are today. While it is painful for me to remember what our people had to endure the last 7 years, we ought to look back to give proper context to my suggestions on how we can move forward as a people. Rodrigo Roa Duterte, then leader of Davao City for more than 2 decades, campaigned for the Philippine presidency during the May 2016 elections, mainly under the promise that he will solve drugs, criminality, and corruption in 3 to 6 months. Enamored by this promise of a quick fix to the crime and narcotics problem, as amplified by online troll farms which spread propaganda and targeted the opposition, the people voted him into office with one of the biggest margins in the nation's electoral history. A massive disinformation campaign was also organized to create a fake illusion that Davao City is among the safest cities in the world, falsely crediting Duterte as effective in fighting crime. This, despite readily available official data, completely stating the opposite, that Davao City has the highest crime rate per capita, and in fact was number 1 in murder, number 2 in rape, number 3 in robbery, and number 5 in theft when Duterte was still at the helm of the local government unit. The propaganda of Duterte's campaign was just effective in clouding the truth. Known as the Punisher, Duterte was under investigation for vigilante-like killings of suspected drug addicts and criminals in Davao City, attributed to the Davao Death Squad, or the DDS. The Human Rights Watch released a report in April 2009 on this prevalent extrajudicial slaying in Davao City, which followed a consistent pattern of targeted killings of civilians. In 2009, the Philippine Commission on Human Rights, which I headed during that time, investigated the phenomenon of DDS killings. In 2011, the CHR released its resolution recommending that the Office of the Ombudsman investigate Duterte for his liability on the numerous killings of in Davao City. But even before proper charges were filed against Duterte, he eventually declared his presidential ambitions and won with a landslide. Within the first year of his presidency, a consistent pattern of killings haunted the country when Oplan Tokhang was declared. Tokhang meant knock and plead in one of our local languages. But instead of knocking and pleading, deaths flooded the streets not only of Metro Manila, but nationwide. Reports of total number of deaths vary. Per government data, 6,252 people were killed in anti-drug operations from July 1, 2016 to May 31, 2022, a number that does not include those killed by unidentified perpetrators. Human rights groups' estimates are grimmer, 12,000 to 30,000. The United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights estimates that, even counting conservatively, at least 8,663 people had been killed in Duterte's drug war. The number of deaths are not readily definite because of the sheer quantity of those victimized. Per another report, victims included at least 122 children who were killed. The Human Rights Watch estimates that the drug war left 20,000 orphans. When I was newly elected as senator, I led a Senate inquiry into the violent drug war, but I was vilified nonstop, ousted from my Senate committee, and eventually unjustly sent to prison on false charges, later on declared by the Human Rights Office of the High Commissioner Working Group as arbitrary detention. I languished in prison for close to 7 years, and until now, I still have pending cases and was only able to secure my liberty on bail. My only fault was I spoke up. Up to this moment, Duterte has not been charged with any crime in relation to the murderous drug war. A lot of people do not dare to cross his path as he remains powerful. Duterte left office with record high plus 81 approval rating, and Duterte's daughter, Sara Duterte, won the vice presidency in another landslide victory. Except in two cases, no one else has been held criminally accountable for the murders that transpired under Duterte's drug war. Prosecutors have not pressed charges against police officers, nor do they investigate the deaths from police operations, citing presumption of regularity of police operations. Even assuming the impossible, that the ombudsman or the DOJ carry out authentic investigations and file criminal charges against the masterminds of the drug war, I do not think any Philippine judge will survive a prolonged trial of his masterminds without being harassed, threatened, or even killed, given the resources of the DDS as the most powerful criminal organization in the country. This is further assuming that judges will be fair and impartial, many of them having been appointed by Duterte himself, from the lowest trial courts all the way up to the Supreme Court. Left to itself, the Philippine justice system cannot handle the prosecution of this criminal entity that ran the entire Philippine government for 6 years and still exercises de facto residual quasi-state powers. On such a backdrop, my first submission for today is to emphasize that there can be no effective transition if we do not deliver justice first. Considering the lack of effective mechanism to hold those accountable for the bloody drug war, it is imperative for the ICC to prosecute the authors of the drug war for the mass murder of our people. It is incumbent for the ICC as a court of last resort to extract accountability under the principle of complementarity. Nevertheless, the ICC should not be the lone body to pursue accountability. Second, I submit that those identified to have been involved in this mass murder may be prosecuted under the principle of universal jurisdiction in foreign courts. International law recognizes that certain crimes are so serious that the duty to prosecute them lies with all nations, including crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide, and torture, because those who commit such heinous crimes are hostis humani generis, or enemies of all mankind. Thus, any nation should have the authority to hold their authors accountable, regardless of where the crime was committed or the nationality of the perpetrator or the victim. In the United States in particular, the Alien Tort Statute may be used by victims of serious human rights violations, especially sins as recognized in Re Estate of Ferdinand E. Marcos human rights litigation. Quote, virtually all of the nations of the world, including the United States and the Philippines, are in agreement that human rights victims should have enforceable rights to fair and adequate compensation, end of quote. Third, the assets of the human rights abusers must be frozen to prevent them from using such resources and power to escape accountability. The Global Magnitsky Act of 2016 was passed in the United States to punish foreign government officials worldwide who are human rights offenders, freeze their assets, and ban them from entering the U.S. Canada passed its own version in October 2017, entitled Justice for Victims of Corrupt Foreign Officials Act. In the same vein, the European Parliament in 2020 also passed the EU Global Human Rights Sanctions Regime. Apart from Duterte and former police general and now Senator Bato de la Rosa, those who implemented the violent drug war and the mass murder of Filipinos must be considered under the list of who should be sanctioned through these various human rights mechanisms. The International Coalition for Human Rights in the Philippines created a list of who should be sanctioned under the different Magnitsky mechanisms and have identified key people who have implemented the violent drug war. The international community must act to sanction the authors of the drug war, not only to set a clear message that gross human rights violations will not be left unpunished, but also to ensure that international human rights guarantees that protect all of humanity will continue to be upheld and respected. Lastly, and perhaps most importantly, the victims and their families are not even accorded the opportunity to recover and heal. It is thus integral that transitional justice mechanisms be put in place. Broadly defined, transitional justice mechanisms are processes that provide acknowledgement, recompense, and solace to victims through various accountability measures with the long-term goal of reconciliation and acknowledgement of the abuses. Measures must be adopted to address the victims and introduce steps to prevent the recurrence of the abuses. The mechanisms are labeled transitional because they are typically implemented during or following atrocities and widespread abuses. The crimes are committed are of a scale that the judicial system by itself is unable to address. The abuses require a broader and different approach. The focus in transitional justice processes is both on victims and on accountability measures that address the society as a whole. Since in the case of Duterte's drug war, the state itself was involved in the atrocities, it is fundamental to have a mechanism to restore the basic values and trust in the systems and institutions of the Philippines. It must be acknowledged that a lot of victims may probably not get the justice that they deserve through the usual domestic justice mechanism because of A, the high quantum of proof that must be established for conviction in a criminal case, which is beyond reasonable doubt, and B, the lack of proper documentation. And in a lot of instances, the deliberate destruction of evidence linking state elements to the commission of the crime. In this light, traditional justice mechanisms can document the incidents outside of the criminal justice system, set up an alternative way to acknowledge the fact of victimization, provide reparations, and enable some sense of vindication for the victims and their families, even outside of the usual criminal justice system.
That was former Philippine Senator Lila De Lima speaking at a recent event organized by StopTheDrugWar.org DRCNet entitled After Drug War, Ending Extrajudicial Drug War Killings and Extending Transitional Justice for Victims. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.